Chariot Solutions TechCast, episode number 78. Andrew Larkin on Zooey and open source at Comcast. The TechCast is brought to you by Chariot Solutions Education Services. If you're on development team working in Java, Spring, Maven, Hibernate, Scala, or Android, we're here to help. For on-site training, one-on-one or group mentoring, or to attend one of our public classes, visit us on the web at chariotsolutions.com/education. This week, we feature a Philadelphia developer, Andrew Larkin, who works at Comcast as an engineer specializing in accessibility for the various web platforms. He's currently working on an open-source JavaScript component framework, Zooey, which provides drag-and-drop, tabbing, and other features, and support for add-ons and additional components. We talked about his project, his background as a developer, and how Comcast supports various open-source initiatives. Let's join the interview. Well, Andrew Larkin, welcome to the Chariot TechCast.
Thank you.
Now, you work for Comcast. What is your actual division of Comcast? Is that Comcast Interactive Media?
It was, actually, until very recently. I've been working with Comcast Interactive Media for the last almost 2 years. I recently moved over as a technical specialist on the accessibility team.
Okay. And so now we're here to talk specifically about a tool that you wrote, or an API that you wrote, called Zooey. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about, you know, your background. So tell me a little bit about you, and you know what your, you know, what your technical interests are, where you came up from in terms of being a developer.
Sure. So I guess if you want to go way back, my technical roots start when I was about 5 years old, and my father actually introduced me to a little BASIC.
All right.
I actually really started my career. I started my career as a graphic designer. So I was doing a lot of graphic design for print. It kind of spawned out of me doing poster designs for theater.
Cool.
And then that kind of just grew into doing web design. And then I suddenly rediscovered my love for actually writing code in JavaScript. In Visual Basic, actually. ASP classic stuff. They were dark times.
Oh yeah, I remember those times. Yeah, where everything is on the page.
Yeah, it was very 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 just right there.
So right.
HTML and a little bit of wacky like ASP stuff going in the background.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, and I actually did that for many many years, and I just got more and more interested in working with user interface and front-end code. I've since actually kind of branched out into other areas. My primary work has really been in JavaScript, but I've become a big fan of Ruby. I've done a lot of work in Ruby, and I've really actually discovered a love of just quirky programming languages. I did my master's in software engineering at Villanova. Actually still working on the thesis for that, technically speaking. And, you know, I just being in the academic environment, I found out that Prolog and crazy programming languages that nobody ever really gets exposed to if they're just doing day-to-day software engineering, web development. So it's kind of cool. You know, it gives me an opportunity to kind of branch out and do some crazy things.
You mentioned Prolog. I remember when I was a kid, I was really into interactive fiction, the Infocom series
yes.
You know, all that stuff.
Absolutely. It's the best part of writing something in Prolog.
It's like the coolest thing. And I think that their Zill interpreter is Prolog based, isn't it? I think it is.
I can't actually answer that definitively.
But that's neat.
I know that one of my favorite Prolog projects that I've worked on was actually a, you know, like an interactive fiction text-based adventure game, you know.
Right.
It's actually, you fly around in the spaceship and instead of opening doors, you're actually like jumping to different hyper speed, hyper jump locations. So it was fun.
Yeah, I used to be really into, like, back in the day where, you know, most people were writing things in Visual Basic, and, you know, I was a Power Builder developer for a while back in the 90s, and I remember even before that I was playing around with different languages, and I found this one called Forth, and that's a language for, like, embedded systems, for example. And the cool thing about that one was that you basically created the language out of primitives that you built yourself. So you create your own dialect. It was really a neat language. Very, very strange. Very, very reverse Polish notation. Everything was very cryptic. But you could, like, basically create your own vocabulary. In fact, you asked it what it had by typing the word words. So, and you would always put things on a stack and pop things off a stack. I guess it was very Lisp-ish that way, yeah. But pretty neat. So anyway, okay, so cool. So I mean, I guess you come at the JavaScript stuff not only from a regular, you know, web page JavaScript junkie, but also hopefully from the functional programmer stuff, right?
Just absolutely, yeah. You know, it's interesting too because JavaScript's one of those languages that it's a dangerous programming language. And I think that a lot of people, you know, they can do a lot of interesting things with JavaScript. JavaScript is one, I love JavaScript because JavaScript's a programming language that somebody who's just getting into programming can really kind of ramp up on really quickly and learn how to do something.
Right.
Because that's the thing. Like, you know, that's the purpose of a hello world is, you know, to have a new developer sit down and be able to just do something. And I think JavaScript gives you a great opportunity to do that, especially if you have, you know, everyone has a browser.
Yeah.
You know, they write a little JavaScript code. You can actually do it right in an inspector if you want to. And you can see, oh, look, I did stuff. And that's great. But there are so many just dark places in JavaScript, this weirdness. And so, you know, one of the things that I've discovered, and this is actually also one of the reasons why I love Ruby, although it's not dark in Ruby, it's actually a little bit nicer and trimmed paths to discovery. But it's a language where you can make some discoveries and you can kind of explore and learn how to do things differently. And then and that's how we end up with stuff like CoffeeScript, you know?
Yeah, right. Exactly. All right. And so so you've been doing this this project Zooey at Comcast. So how did Comcast actually, how did you guys approach open source there?
It's an interesting question actually, because you know, most of the time when people say to people, you know, oh yeah, Comcast does open source, it's like, what? Comcast does what? Because it's not something you'd think a company like Comcast does. You know, everyone's like, oh yeah, Google open sources stuff, but like Comcast open sources stuff? And we do. And I'll be honest, actually, it was something that was going on even before I joined the company.
Mm-hmm.
So Comcast actually has a GitHub account, you know, that we publish stuff to. So if you go to, you know, GitHub/Comcast, you can see all of the different projects that Comcast has open source. And so the idea, it was a gradual process. You know, I think at first that some people were kind of a little wary of some of the stuff they were putting out there, putting out some of our tools and things that we were just kind of using behind the scenes, like JRugged and stuff like that. You know, it was a little bit more comfortable for some people because, you know, there wasn't really too much that was proprietary about that, that really wasn't touching any of our products. And when we started talking about open sourcing things that were part of our UI, our front-end code, there was a little bit of hesitation on parts, and we had to kind of vet the idea with legal and go through that whole process. But in the end, I think everyone was really excited because, you know, this is an opportunity for Comcast, and I think everyone really kind of sees this, to really kind of show not only, you know, what we can do and what we're working on and some of the cool things that we're doing, but it's also a really great opportunity for us to kind of get out there and say, like, hey, look, you know, we are part of this community. We are, you know, involved. And I think that's what really gets people excited, is that we're, a lot of us, especially within Comcast Interactive Media, but also I think it's really spread to the rest of the company, are really involved in the tech community. And we want to be able to say, you know, hey, I work for Comcast, and yes, we contribute to open source, and yes, this is something that's really important to us as a company.
And like, how do you do the licensing for open source there? What license do you generally settle on?
Generally, it's an Apache license.
Okay, yeah.
I don't think we deviate too often from that. That seems to be what everyone is happy with.
Right. All right. So now Zooey is a widget library, right, for JavaScript?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So let's talk about that a little bit. So it's XOOIE, Zooey.
Yes.
Yes. GitHub.com/Comcast/Zooey.
Yep.
So let's talk about that a little bit. What was the motivation for building the library, and tell me a little bit about it.
Well, actually, I think it's the motivation behind it really summed up by a colleague of mine, Jeff Avalon, said, I want this to be the last bleeping carousel that we ever make.
No one's ever happy with them, right? Yeah.
Well, you know, the thing was is that, you know, this... So at Comcast, we actually have, periodically have what are called lab weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And what those are is those are a week where we actually dedicate, you know, engineers and designers and actually really anyone within our technology and product organization are given the opportunity to just work on a project that they want to work on. You know, generally speaking, it's going to be something that has to do with something that's going to be Comcast-y, you know, so
yeah,
projects that are relating to data and revolving around media, or, you know, things that are actually going to use our products and services in a new way. But, you know, it's kind of birthed out of this idea that, you know, Google has their 20% time, which has led to Gmail and all these great products that we actually have come to know and love.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, a lot of people in the organization were really excited about that. So that became a thing. And LabWeek is really cool. We're actually in the middle of a LabWeek right now. But it's really cool because it gives us an opportunity to say, you know what, there's a problem and we want to solve it. And this is our opportunity to do it in the way that we think we should do it. So this actually came out of a LabWeek project. We decided that we wanted to introduce a Ruby on Rails framework to our web development. So we actually sat down and said, okay, we're going to develop a Rails, take one of our websites and actually build it in Rails. And so we did, but when we were doing this, we were thinking, well, if we're making, you know, going ahead and doing the next generation of middleware, let's do something about our front end code too. So we wanted to really create something that was going to be a highly reusable UI widget library, because, you know, especially when you have so many different types of websites that you're working on, you could have, you know, five different carousels that are implemented in five different ways. And the thing is that, you know, if you look at a lot of UI frameworks, such as jQuery UI or YUI, you know, they're great. You know, these are really great, easy to implement frameworks, but you're kind of required to adhere to the style and structure and layout and markup of what that widget looks like. So what we really wanted to do is we wanted something that was going to be easy to implement, but was still going to give us the flexibility to be able to use this again and again across different types of interfaces and different types of web projects. And so we sat down and we started thinking what that would look like, and we came up with Zooey. We came up with something that is really modular, really easy to implement, really easy to extend if you want to make changes or add stuff, functionality onto it without really changing the functionality of the base module.
So when you're building an application front end, and I guess you had the carousel, you've got, looks like, the tab control, a drop tab control. Those are the first three, right?
Yeah.
And so let's say you want to plop a tab control on a page. So I guess what you import the base style sheet for Zooey, and the script for Zooey, and then what do you use, like, data tags on the HTML, or how do you set something like that up?
Sure. Actually, so here's the cool thing about Zooey, right? It's agnostic of markup and styles. So there's no style sheet that you have to load with this. All you have to do is just load the JavaScript. And what's even cooler is that in order to implement this, you don't even have to have any knowledge of JavaScript at all. We really wanted this to be a tool that was going to be easier, not just for developers to implement, but also designers when they're going through their prototype process. So what it uses, it relies on, as you said, HTML5 data attributes.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, really, to get one of these things instantiated, all you really need to do is to identify a element as a Zooey widget. So we have a data widget type property that actually just assign that to whatever widget you're instantiating.
Mm-hmm.
And then it uses data-role properties that tag the important elements, the important controls that are going to be inside of that widget. So in this way, you don't have to necessarily adhere to a specific structure in your markup. You can actually just say, okay, this thing's a widget. Say if we're doing a carousel.
All right.
This is going to be my carousel content, which is usually going to be just a collection of things that are going to be in the carousel. And then I'm going to identify a couple of controls that are going to be my back and forward controls to actually scroll the carousel. And then there's a few optional ones. Maybe you want to actually have pagination, so we have a little display thing that you can edit. And all these are just instantiated using just these data role properties. It's kind of keying off of kind of like what ARIA does,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of identifying markup on the page as having some sort of value as pertaining to the UI.
Okay. Interesting.
And And the cool thing is that we actually set it up so that, you know, like I said, you don't really need to know any JavaScript. It does automatically parse the entire page and actually find these widget types, and then in one fell swoop goes and snags everything that it needs to using require.js and instantiates everything on the page.
So if I'm looking at the project here, what would be the best place to start as a developer? Where would you look?
In the
or is that the challenge?
So we've been at a pre-release state for about a year now.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the things about open source that's really cool is that, you know, this is something that is great. You know, this is something that I work on, you know, and have fun doing in my free time.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I've discovered in this process is really great to go out and find other contributors. And, by the way, I might add, we are definitely looking for other people outside of Comcast to contribute, because honestly, we developed this tool to be a tool for developers, and that tool can be only so good as the developers that are telling us what they need and what they want in the kind of tool they'd be using for UI framework. But I've been actually working and putting together documentation, because I think it's not necessarily intuitive right away when people look at this, because there's a paradigm that we have, which is that, okay, if we're doing something in JavaScript with UI, it has to all happen in JavaScript.
Right.
And so, you know, traditionally that's been, you know, we're using like jQuery, something like that. You're, you know, selecting from the DOM, or you're actually creating a jQuery and a DOM element using jQuery and then injecting it into the DOM. And then you're adding styles to that element. You know, these are inline styles. And then you're manipulating that object in JavaScript. And JavaScript becomes what I like to refer to as kind of like a role monger. So, you know, whereas you have really three aspects to web development, you know, markup, CSS, and JavaScript, you know, this traditional way of doing these kind of rich dynamic UI has been, let's have JavaScript do everything. And so it's a little bit of a break from that for a lot of people to see how that works. So I've been working very hard. The GitHub account does have a lot of documentation and information. It gives some people some basic information as to where to get started. And I really encourage people, when they start playing around with this, just try to instantiate something and see what happens. Because it doesn't take a lot to actually get it going. You know, once you put the code on the page and you just tag everything as a data widget type equals blah, you know, then you'll actually see it start to do something. Even if not everything is there, it still works. It still does something. So you can see how that actually works and how it affects your markup, your code.
Gotcha. So for now, you'll have to dig a little bit into the source code to take a look at what you're doing. But you will be able to at least play with it and get things going.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that we've been in pre-release now for about a year, and we're finally doing an official 1.0 release on August 22nd.
Cool.
I had to commit myself to a day, and, you know, Wednesdays are, actually I think it's a Thursday, but, you know, middle of the week is always a good day to do a release, I think, so.
Right.
We are doing official release, and with that is going to come a lot more official documentation, because we've made a lot of changes to the way things work and because of the discoveries that we've made. But yeah, now it's one of the nice things about the next version of Zoomy that's actually coming out in the next month is that you can actually have just a base widget that won't really do anything. It's just called widget.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually added a true kind of extend method that allows you to kind of build widgets off of each other.
Cool. Yeah.
And so you can actually instantiate a widget, and it'll just be instantiated, and you can see, oh, well, that I see what that did. It added this, you know, index class to it, and it, you know, added a few data attributes that are going to be used for tracking instances when we start to reinstantiate these things. So you can actually see it work right away, just with some very, very limited functionality, and then just see how things kind of add on top of each other. And one of the cool things about Zoomy that's really cool is the fact that it is extensible. So the idea is that we want developers, when they implement Zoomy, to say, you know what, I like your carousel, that's great, but I really need it to scroll automatically on a timer. And so if you want to do that, if there's something that you need it to do, Zoomy has components called add-ons. And the idea behind add-ons is that you can create a self-contained module that will be instantiated and loaded with the base widget. It's a completely self-contained, separate bit of code. You can do whatever you need in there. You can reference back to the parent module from within that module itself, and then add on any additional functionality. And it would only be instantiated for that particular instance of the widget. So we want developers, when they're using this, to be able to say, you know what, I really need slightly different functionality that doesn't quite exist in the core framework, and make that easy for that savvy developer to be able to say, oh, okay, well, this is how I do it. I can see, you know, based on the documentation, this is how I create, you know, an AMD module that's going to be self-contained and have all the necessary properties, and then have their functionality kind of added on. And this is something that actually became really important, because as we started to use this for other projects, we started to realize that there were special needs. So, you know, Comcast is actually pushing out a next-gen UI called, we're calling it X2. It was just announced at NCTA. And part of that is a web experience, and we used Zooey as the core of that. But there was a lot of additional functionality that had to get added on. So that actually is kind of building off of these base Zooey widgets, reusing them in creative ways and extending them with additional functionality while still maintaining the integrity of the core framework.
So it sounds like you were interested in kind of contributing widgets to a framework, and you know, you wanted to take a look at Zooey, and if you liked it, then this would be kind of the time to get involved.
Absolutely, because here's, like I said before, you know, this is only as good as of a tool for developers as we have developers giving us feedback.
Right. Yeah.
So, and you know, this was actually one of the core principles behind Zooey. This, you know, we wanted to create a simple developer experience. You know, we didn't want it to be something that people were going to look at and say, like, oh, well, you know, it just works, you know.
Magic, yeah, right.
Yeah, it's like, oh, this is fantastic, it's magical, great, contribute. I don't know how it works.
Right.
You know, and that's, I think it's important in open source, is to consider the fact that you're not dealing with just a team of developers that are working on this project. You're making something for everybody. And I think this is actually, you know, I work in accessibility, so the idea of universal design is really important to me. But I think this is really something that extends into how we write code. You know, as developers that are contributing to open source, we definitely have to consider the fact that we're writing something that other people are going to have to look at later. And so I think it's so important to think about that when you're writing code. You know, and it's not just writing tests. I mean, of course you test your code. Of course you know, have that code coverage. It's really thinking about what that code looks like to somebody who's looking at that for the first time. You know, how can they trace their path back through, you know, classes that extend on classes that could extend on classes? You know, how do you, you know, look through a closure and actually see what things are doing? What's conveyed by the code itself? So I think that's one of the things that it really excites me about Zooey, is that it's really an exercise in making code simple. And hopefully, you know, as more people get introduced to it and really make discoveries, that they'll be able to say, you know what, I think your code is simple, but this little function block right here, you know, boggles my mind. And I could say either, well, you know, that's really clever code. Or I could actually say, yeah, you're right. You know what? I'm going to try to simplify that and find a better way to do that.
Right.
Or actually have them do it themselves, mm-hmm. and contribute that back. And I say, like, oh, yeah, that is a much simpler way. Yeah. Thank you for pointing out that my cleverness.
So, you've done some other contributions in the past, right? So mm-hmm. I was looking around and you know, just kind of clicking before we started, and I saw that you had a CSS testing framework.
CSS.
So talk about the challenge in something like that. I mean, that sounds like that must have been a mental gymnastics exercise to some degree.
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite things about, you know, sometimes about being a developer is sometimes, you know, you have that what if moment, right? So it's like, what if you wrote a test framework for CSS? Because CSS isn't a programming language.
It's directives, essentially.
Yeah. It's the rules, basically, mm-hmm. coming down. So how do you, and we have linter, we have CSS lint, and we have, you know, we have things that are validating CSS for us and actually saying, yeah, we forgot, you know, to put a semicolon or something like that in there. But, you know, we don't really have anything that actually, like, really validates. Because the thing is that when you get on really large, you know, like enterprise-scale projects, legacy projects, you know, that have been around for years, and, you know, people are different, many different developers are coming in, and they're, you know, adding features, and then you end up with these kind of collisions between CSS rules.
Yeah.
And have unexpected behavior. And this actually came out of me kind of working with one of our older code bases and actually getting frustrated because these defects were just popping up every time we'd add a new feature, where some other page that we would never even think about that's been around and, you know, is hanging on for dear life because it gets just the right threshold of traffic. Suddenly something changed because we added a class rule that actually affected that. And so I was thinking to myself, I was like, wouldn't it be great if we could have some sort of way of actually looking at all of the CSS in our project and making and saying, aha, you know what? This is what you just did here. This is going to actually potentially cause you to have a problem. And the funny thing is that the project ended up asking the question as I developed it, is the cascade part of cascading style sheets really a good idea?
What do you think?
So, and I presented this, and the framework works-ish. It was something that actually got put in the back burner a while back. I'd love to revisit it.
Sure.
But it does actually kind of say, okay, you know, as a developer, go in and, you know, inline, just kind of write what your intention is for this class. I expect this to be overridden. I expect this to be preserved no matter what, you know, kind of setting that sort of like precedence on that without having to drop an important tag in there and ruining everything.
Yeah, right.
So, and it was interesting because, you know, when I presented this and I started talking to people about it, some people were like, oh my God, that's awesome. And some people were like, you're mad. And you know, I kind of can see both people's perspectives. It's a challenging project because it really, but it's the kind of project that I like because it's a project that challenges us to really question the standards that we have.
Sure.
Every single one of us has the potential to be a contributor to the next generation of standards for whatever programming language or whatever technology we're working with. We're all have the potential to be innovators. We all have that chance to actually say, you know what, we can do better. And you know what, we can do better. I mean, if somebody says that, you know, the end-all be-all is JavaScript or even Ruby for that matter, and all the Rubyists out there, I'm on your side. I love Ruby. You know, it's not the end-all be-all.
It's there's a vocal group.
There's going to be something that might be better, but more importantly, there'll always be something that's different.
Right.
And I think that was one of the interesting things about Expect CSS. Whether or not, now it's not a tool that we're using. You know, it turns out it's actually a little bit of an impediment for most people to actually write, you know, these inline test blocks for other CSS. And it wasn't, you know, there wasn't any benefit. Like, you know, you do test-driven development. There's things that come out of that for you. There's actually things that benefit your experience in writing tests and actually then making the pass. You make interesting discoveries. And I wasn't really getting that using this framework. So I think that as a tool, it wasn't great, but as an experiment, it was awesome. It was just really great to be able to just kind of hack at a problem. It was a what-if situation, and it really made me think about the way that CSS works. And it changed the way that I wrote CSS in the end, especially when I started moving over into working with SAS and CSS.
And getting some real reuse out of it.
Yeah, and so, you know, it really had me think about, you know, the way that we write classes, the way that we write CSS rules, the way that we, you know, specifying and making sure that those are very, very unique names, you know.
Yeah, that's definitely certainly one thing that if you're using things like, you know, table cell, mm-hmm. I mean, everything's gonna, you know, you never know.
That can cause some problems.
You know, rectangle. Well, guess what? Yeah. And you know, I kind of think that there's another framework that I've seen that has kind of similar issues when you start digging into it. Like in the Java world, we've got Spring, and Spring's very testable. But there's a piece of Spring called Webflow, and it's kind of this XML state machine. You know, you like when you do a checkout. And you have certain steps that you have to go through. It's kind of like a server-side state. You submit your next step, and it goes to the next state. And they wrote a whole JUnit testing framework for it. And that's great, but the whole point of Webflow was to quickly express your flow rules in XML. Mm-hmm. And then every time you change it, all your tests will break. So it's like, it's, you know, it's kind of like the thought experiment was great, but the practicality of it, to me, seems rather low. But you don't know until you try. You know, there's great things to be learned from making, you know, miscalculations and mistakes. It's how you, you know, learn more about the world. If scientists didn't make mistakes, they'd never get anywhere, you know, or make a hypothesis and it was wrong. So, yeah, that's why they call us computer scientists and not computer artists, right?
Exactly. You know, even an artist has a lot of bad paintings.
Yes.
Is that a really good one?
Woodshedding.
It's funny because, we actually have a lot of, innovation and there's a drive to be, looking into not only doing stuff that's open source, but also thinking about patents and that kind of innovation as well. And,
right.
You know, a lot of people that I talk to, they're really intimidated by this idea of patenting at first because, there was like, well, I don't have a good idea. Well, the thing is that, if you're in a role as an engineer where your job is basically to come up with new technologies and make patents, if you're getting 50% of your stuff patented, you're a god. You're amazing,
I'm sure,
There's a lot of innovation is really about, breaking some eggs and trying things out. I can mix a whole bunch of metaphors here. Falling down and getting back on your bike and... Oh, I got metaphors.
Getting back on that bike, that's right. Get off my horse, right. All right, great. Andrew, any way we want to kind of plug what you're working on? So again, it's github.com/comcast/XOOIE, correct?
Yep.
So that's Zooey. And any other place that you do you tweet a lot? Are you on Twitter, that kind of place?
I am. I do. I tweet. I tweet a modest amount. I'm not an over Twitterer.
Right.
You can follow me at @alarkindesign. I have a much neglected blog at andrewlarkin.net.
Yeah, Twitter kind of kills that, and Facebook and all these other, and LinkedIn, and
I have ideas, and
right.
Blog, blah, who reads that? Twitter, yay. and I also I have an accessibility meetup that I run.
Oh, nice.
Philadelphia Accessibility Forum, where we have a bunch of developers that are coming together and actually talking about issues surrounding universal design, of course, and how we can actually create universal designs. But I also wanted to make it a place where people can come to ask questions, especially because a lot of us are now facing compliance issues with regards to legislation that's been passed relating to users with disabilities.
Right, right.
So that's a place that I want to make it a safe place where people can actually come and kind of share information. And of course, Zooey. Zooey is a something that I hope more people can actually contribute to and use. We do have it actually released right now as a Ruby on Rails gem.
Cool.
It sits on rubygems.org, so that's out there floating around. I'll have the Node package up soon, and I've been also asked to create a Maven jar. So.
You'll eventually get to that.
Java folks as well.
It's funny because Java folks, we live in Maven jars, so.
Yeah, I know. It's like those are the three things that you'll get like a huge slice of the web
development. You got a huge number there. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, it's something that I'm hoping more people can get involved with, and with other Comcast projects, we have some really cool stuff that's out there. We have JRuggy, which is a Java library, some utilities that we use internally. We have a SAS Lint project that was actually developed by John Raviello, who's worked with Chris Epstein to actually develop this linter for SAS.
Cool.
That's based off of CSS Lint. So there's some cool stuff out there. So I encourage people to check it out, and I encourage people to contribute.
Thanks to Andrew for taking the time on Monday night to record this podcast. We recorded the show using an iPad Mini, Skype, Boss Jock Studio, and a Griffin iMic microphone. That is the ultimate portable podcasting platform. Our themes are Free Theme 3 and 4 from podcastthemes.com. Libsyn provides our bandwidth, and our feed is generated using Blueberry's PowerPress plugin. If you're a developer looking for a regular news show tailoring to your interests, give our other show, the Chariot Developer News, a try. You can find that on iTunes or on the Emerging Tech site, emergingtech.chariotsolutions.com, where you'll also find our podcasts and screencasts from various emerging technologies for the enterprise conferences, which feature speakers such as Doug Leah, Andy Hunt, Bob Martin, Douglas Crockford, and many, many more. That's emergingtech.chariotsolutions.com. For the TechCast, I'm Ken Rimple.